This is the second part of our two-part series all about gestational diabetes with Lily Nichols, RDN. In this episode, we do an overview of testing options and discuss some of the lesser-known nuances of normal pregnancy metabolism, getting into some fascinating details around low blood sugars, continuous glucose monitors, and nutritive ketosis in pregnancy. We then discuss the conventional dietary recommendations and how they are insufficient and outdated. And then we discuss the method of blood sugar management that Lily recommends to her clients to achieve the best outcomes. Also discussed is how the diagnosis of gestational diabetes can really come to wreck birth plans, even when it may not be applicable anymore. And then we talk a little bit about how we can manage that the best with your provider. So here we go, and make sure that you listen to part one.
Welcome to Healthy as a Mother, the podcast for becoming and being a mother, with your co-hosts, Dr. Leah Gordon and Dr. Morgan McDermott, two naturopathic doctors who get it.
Each week, we teach you how to be the healthiest mother you can be, from fertility and preconception to pregnancy and birth prep, through postpartum and throughout motherhood, empowering you with the natural health guidance and education you're not getting elsewhere, so you can confidently navigate the broken system at large.
The real, the raw, the untalked about. And remember, this information is not intended to diagnose, treat, or manage any disease. Always consult with your doctor before making any changes.
The metabolic needs of pregnancy, postpartum healing, and making breast milk require more minerals than in other times of your life. And staying truly, deeply hydrated during these times is very important. Nowadays, there are more options for this than ever, and ingredient quality manufacturing integrity is very important for Dr. Leah and I. That's why we love Redmond Relight electrolyte powders. Mined in the USA, Relight contains Redmond's ancient unrefined sea salt with 60 plus trace minerals in addition to the appropriate proportions and forms of calcium, potassium, chloride, and magnesium that pregnant and breastfeeding moms need. Pregnancy demands a huge increase in blood volume and synthesis of an entire new baby, and that requires, you guessed it, minerals. This is the perfect blend to be sipping on during your labor or to have mixed into your bedside water bottle during breastfeeding. It tastes amazing, and my favorite flavors oscillate between mixed berry, strawberry lemonade, or lemon lime. Grab a sample pack option to try them yourself and use code HEALTHYMOTHER for 15% off your order of any of the products that Redmond has to offer, including their OG sea salt, other seasoning salts, natural toothpaste, bentonite clays, and more. Happy hydrating! Okay, welcome back, Lily Nichols. We are now in the part two of our gestational diabetes episode. So if you have not listened to part one, that will be in the show notes, and it definitely needs to be listened before this one. Otherwise, none of this will make sense because we are just going to hit the ground running, talking about testing and management and also how this diagnosis of gestational diabetes can change your birth and your birth plans. So thank you for coming back, Lily. And let's go ahead and start. Can you give us, we did talk a little bit about testing on the first episode, but let's sort of do an umbrella overview and your, you know, best clinical judgment and opinions there of how someone could manage going about this.
From the diagnosis of gestational diabetes perspective or management and watching their blood sugar?
Let's just talk about testing first. Like, what are the testing options? What do you think? Yeah. And then how do you think maybe somebody could navigate picking one of those?
So with the testing options, you have the so-called standard of care, the glucose tolerance test. This can, I think, make sense in some instances, particularly if you have a person eating kind of standard American diet. But in some instances, it's not the best choice, such as when somebody's eating a fairly low-carb diet. Unless you carb load in the week prior to the diet, there's a chance of a false positive on that test. Some people are also not comfortable with the ingredients of it. And there's some different options out there that have better ingredients. But at the end of the day, like, the purpose of this test is to see how your body responds to a specified dose of pure glucose, and whether or not your blood sugar comes out within range or higher than average. Some other options, really my preferred option if you're talking about screening at the 24 to 28 week window and you don't want to do a glucose tolerance test, would be to test your blood sugar at home, home glucose monitoring, and see whether your blood sugar readings come out within range or whether they are high. This one is a bit tricky on the clinician side because many people do not have training in maternal blood sugar levels. You know, your goal blood sugar is different during pregnancy than outside of pregnancy. The standards are a bit more strict, and it gets a little wishy-washy in terms of, well, how many readings do you have to have high that would necessarily qualify you as having gestational diabetes? It leaves a little more gray area. So, you know, pros and cons to either one, but if you're not going to do a glucose tolerance test, I think that's a good option. There is arguably a third option, which would be to screen earlier in pregnancy, which you can do with a hemoglobin A1C, but this really is only an accurate diagnostic if it's done in the first trimester. Beyond that phase, there's too many changes physiologically to make it accurate. So you do want to choose one of the two I just discussed for the latter time point in pregnancy.
Okay. And so say somebody in the first trimester, say that they're like 11 weeks or something, they get a hemoglobin A1C. And if it is in the higher range, do we think they still have time to work on that and then maybe, you know, double check and hold it against something like if they did at-home blood glucose monitoring? Or I know it's pretty predictive, but do we think that maybe it's like a little bit of a too early of a diagnosis and that things may change? Or what do you see with that?
So I think really what the A1C is identifying is prediabetes, which most individuals with prediabetes will have blood sugar in the range that we would call it gestational diabetes. That's really what's going on. There's a pre-existing blood sugar issue outside of pregnancy. So what I would say, whether or not it like qualifies you as having gestational diabetes, some of this depends on what screening guidelines your clinic is following. If your clinic is following the California Diabetes and Pregnancy Program guidelines, also known as Sweet Success, that qualifies you as gestational diabetic. An A1C in the pre-diabetic range, 5.7% or higher, we treat it as if it is gestational diabetes for the remainder of the pregnancy. Now, your office might not follow those guidelines. They might not think a high A1C is indicative of anything, in which case, I mean, either way, regardless of like whether it's written on your chart or not, I would say if your A1C comes out high, this is a sign that there's some blood sugar insulin dysregulation in your system. And I would absolutely keep an eye on your blood sugar for the remainder of your pregnancy. Whether or not you can implement enough dietary and lifestyle changes that you will then go on to pass a later glucose tolerance test with flying colors or not, that's hard to predict. You know, can you pull that off or not? Can you pull off blood sugar management in a healthy range with your, you know, your day-to-day choices? Yeah, absolutely. I have plenty of cases where we identified a high A1C early on, technically qualifying them as having gestational diabetes, and then they have a perfectly healthy pregnancy, no issues. Can you handle a really heavy glucose load with a glucose tolerance test without it coming out high? That's surprisingly hard to predict. So the data would say that's, you know, 98%+ chance that you're going to fail it. I would say not. That's not always the case if somebody has implemented a lot of diet and lifestyle changes. But say, what if you are managing it with a low carb diet and you don't carb load prior to your glucose tolerance test? Like, you still might fail the test. You know what I mean? Like, it's just a different type of test. We're trying to see how does your body deal with a large bolus of glucose all taken in one sitting without anything else in your system. It is, it's a tricky one.
Yeah. Okay. I can see what you mean. It's like, it's much more of a lived in experience sort of day-to-day lifestyle assessment and judgment of multiple data points. And yeah, whether or not the clinician, whether it's an OB or a midwife, is open to that, knows what to do with that, is able to make those sorts of calls and changes, because sometimes they're really bound by, you know, hospital or clinic policy, and it doesn't matter what their individual thought might be around it. They might say, you know, I know this person's number is higher here, but then when we actually look at this and that and the other thing, then we see that these risks for the baby and for mom, if in a typical unmanaged blood sugar case, are not actually applying here. They sometimes can't necessarily make that sort of like, you know, write it off your chart, like erase it if it was seen at one point. So I guess this is all just to say that this is like a very, very gray, sometimes it's a clear black and white diagnosis, but there is a lot of gray as well. And especially if we're making changes, it sounds like. So you mentioned one thing prior, which was that the target blood sugar range for a pregnant woman is going to be different. And so whether they have the training or not to understand that, can you tell us what is that in case somebody maybe is doing blood sugars at home or has a continuous glucose monitor, something like that? What should they be looking for in kind of baseline glucose levels and then post-meal responses?
So even that is a tricky question to answer because there are different guidelines from different organizations. So if we're talking about the more stringent guidelines, again, California Diabetes and Pregnancy Program, which follows most of what is used internationally, they're looking at keeping fasting blood sugar below 90 milligrams per deciliter, and your post-meal blood sugar is typically below 120 milligrams per deciliter. Whereas if you go by American Diabetes Association, ACOG, some of these other organizations, they're applying maybe a slightly more stringent fasting criteria than outside of pregnancy, but certainly not the one associated with the lowest adverse outcomes for mom and baby. So they might target fasting blood sugar to less than 95 or even 100 milligrams per deciliter. And then post-meal readings, they might target for less than 140 milligrams per deciliter.
Which, whoa, that's a big change.
Yeah, and that's about the same as, you know, diabetes goals for type 2 diabetes post-meal. So they're not specific to pregnancy. So the first ones that I mentioned, the more stringent ones, these fall a little more closely toward the average blood sugar responses we see in a healthy pregnant individual who does not have any signs of gestational diabetes. They're actually still higher than that. But typically, we're seeing fasting blood sugar readings in a healthy pregnant individual from like 70s, 80s milligrams per deciliter on average. And after meals, average blood sugar is typically below 110 milligrams per deciliter. So, you know, if we're trying to target to what is physiologically normal, there are some researchers calling for us to even drop those standards like even lower. So just calling that out, that that is still kind of up for debate. But generally speaking, we're dropping our blood sugar goals lower during pregnancy than we are outside of pregnancy. And that is because the body maintains slightly lower blood sugar levels in pregnancy on average than when you're not pregnant.
Okay. And so then when somebody's going to be looking at their post-meal blood glucose, whether they're going to finger prick test it or they're looking on their continuous glucose monitor, what is the time frame that they should be testing that after they've eaten?
This is also something that's up for debate. So I just want to give the lay of the land, you know,
no,
in case
I love
I
it.
Have any yes. Gestational diabetes like researchers following this. So the guidelines will vary between testing at 1 hour or 2 hours after a meal. Typically, if you're just doing a single finger prick with a glucometer, really the goal is that that post-meal check is hitting your peak blood sugar levels, right? So for most people, their blood sugar is going to peak closer to the 1 hour mark than the 2 hour mark. Usually by the 2 hour mark, you should be returning closer to baseline, like fasting blood sugar readings. But it depends on which guidelines you're following, and different clinics do different things. Some test the 1 hour mark, some test the 2 hour mark. Sometimes you have people with such a degree of insulin resistance that their blood sugar gets high and then stays high for a long time. And so you might want to test at 2 hours to see if it has indeed come down. So with a single finger prick, I'm usually opting for the 1 hour test. Or really, if you're not going to be super specific or you forget or whatever, anytime within like 45 minutes to maybe 90 minutes after a meal, sometime in that range is usually when you're going to hit peak blood sugar. Now, if you're wearing a CGM, you'll see when the peak happens and when it starts to fall and how quickly it falls. You just get a lot more data from a CGM. And so you don't really have to worry as much about exactly at what point you're checking your blood sugar because your CGM is doing it automatically. And you can monitor that peak and how quickly you spike, how slowly you spike, whether it's a spike or just a kind of small rise and fall. That the CGM just gives you far more data to work with.
Okay. And so then let's talk, I know this isn't really, this is sort of the opposite, but low blood sugar readings are also common in pregnancy, especially like in the middle of the night. In people who are wearing the CGMs, they may see that. What is your thought there? I know that that's another, you know, something given the nature of diabetes in general, But I think with these times of, you know, with pregnancy and then breastfeeding too, it's common for women to have to wake in the night to eat. And what's going on physiologically? Can you explain that a little bit more? The continuous glucose monitors, I think, are really cool, but also I think maybe some women who are like so data driven might look a little too much or just be like, what is happening? You know what I mean? Where there's like, yeah. They may have never known that that was happening.
Yeah. And I can speak to this even personally, because I wore a CGM several times during my second pregnancy, just using myself as a guinea pig. And I did come out low a lot of times at night. We have to remember the limitations of the, you know, CGM sensors. They're not as accurate at lower blood sugar readings, especially the flash glucose monitors like the Libre has been noted to be particularly inaccurate as you start getting to lower and lower blood sugar readings. So just keep that in mind, first of all. You can have, with any CGM, you can have an issue of like pressure compression on the CGM, which will falsely lower your readings. A CGM is measuring your interstitial glucose. It's measuring the glucose in the fluid between your cells. Okay. It's not actually your blood sugar. It's a proxy of your blood sugar. So if your arm, usually you wear one of these CGM monitors on the outside of your arm or back of your arm, if you're laying on that side and it's compressed and therefore there's not as much circulation in that area and that interstitial fluid is not circulating as we would think, you'll get these falsely low readings. That can definitely happen. And being aware of that to not sleep on it is helpful. We also need to keep in mind that this so-called normal for, or like the cutoff for hypoglycemia is different in pregnancy than it is outside of pregnancy. So outside of pregnancy, our cutoff is 70 milligrams per deciliter. And in pregnancy, it's 60 milligrams per deciliter. A lot of the CGMs will say that you're low if you're anything below 70. You could be 65 and it'll show low on your CGM when it's actually totally fine. But I even personally had some readings like in the 50s, occasionally like 45 or something. That is probably more to do with an inaccuracy with the CGM sensor itself. So what I'd recommend doing if you're concerned, because really you don't see pathological levels of hypoglycemia in individuals unless they are on glucose lowering medications or have an excessive dose of insulin. You just don't. Like, your body is not going to drop your blood sugar to a dangerously low level that's going to harm you or baby unless there is some outside force that is causing that to happen, because our bodies are really, really finely tuned to keep blood sugar levels in a very precise range when all is going well. So what I recommend doing is getting up and like checking your blood sugar with a finger stick regular glucometer, checking your capillary glucose, which is actually your blood sugar, and see where it's at. Every single time that I did that, my blood sugar was fine. It wasn't too low. This is a just faulty nature of CGMs and lower blood sugar. And because your blood sugar is already erring on the lower side in pregnancy and you have sort of these like swings in accuracy as you get to those lower readings, yeah, you're more likely to see things low. But never once was I actually below 60 by glucometer. So check on that. I will say, if you wake up and you are finding yourself waking hungry often, eat. You probably actually need to eat some food. And I remember having spans of times in my pregnancies where, like, no matter what I do in the evening, I was like, man, I'm like hungry. I need to eat something in the middle of the night. That's fine. Your body, your metabolism is on overdrive in pregnancy. Just eat. In an ideal world, we'd be able to make some shifts in the pre-bedtime run-up where we'd make sure you're nourished enough to have the fuel to, you know, run you the whole night. But again, if your metabolism is just so high, sometimes you do really need to wake up to eat a snack. And if that's you, go for it. And you can check your blood sugar to see where you're at, but it's very, very rare that I ever have somebody where by actual finger stick glucometer, they're below 60 overnight, unless it's a over too high of a dose of insulin or medication, blood sugar lowering medication.
Okay, that's so fascinating. Thank you for saying all of that, because I have not heard that yet about the compression. And when you're sleeping on your side, and especially as you're heavier in your pregnancy and, you know, that weight is even pushed more. But even if you're not, it's just if you're sleeping on your right arm or something, there could be an extreme amount of pressure happening there. Yeah. This is a really good point. And most people probably wouldn't, they'd think, oh, I have a CGM, I don't need to have the finger stick one. But really, they're not that expensive. You know, you can go and the strips are, but if you're using them very infrequently, then it can be affordable. Yeah. And if we're worried, right, we need to. But yeah, same with me. With all four of my pregnancies, I'd have to wake up in the middle of the night often. I have just an extremely fast metabolism, though, always. And even with breastfeeding, up until just recently, my baby just turned 12 months old. And up until very, very recently, I was waking in the night to eat still. And now that I've night weaned her, so I'm not nursing in the night, I'm not even creating more metabolic pressure right on my system to make that breast milk, I'm finally sleeping through the night and not hungry. But if she wakes up, if somebody wakes me up for some reason and I like, you know, get up to pee and I try to lay back down, I am still like hungry in the middle of the night, and it's banana pants to me. And I'm just, maybe I should get a continuous glucose monitor and see what's happening. Because I'm like, I eat a lot too. And so it's just, everybody's different with these kinds of things. This has sort of been the picture of my whole life though. And my family, it's interesting. We have a high incidence of type 1 diabetes in my family. And then we do. And then my brother and I though are we run hypoglycemic like all of the time.
I'm also prone to hypoglycemia. So I get it. I have to stay on top of it. And for me, it's like the protein, getting enough protein and fat is key. I know they say treat your hypoglycemia with more carbs, but for me, that just drives the never-ending cycle. But I also don't do well with extremely low-carb keto or something, right? Like there's a balance there, but I have to really, really drive the protein. That's the only way out. And, you know, with the, like you said, metabolic pressure of pregnancy or nursing, and arguably nursing is an even higher metabolic demand than pregnancy. Sometimes the answer simply is to eat, like just eat more often, including in the middle of the night, if you have to, just to like,
yeah, I mean, float. The thing that makes me feel the best in the middle of the night is like either a big scoop of nut butter with some honey in it, or just plain nut butter, or like a piece of cheese. I have to eat something, yeah, extremely like thick and filling. Otherwise I just won't be able to go back to sleep. Cause just so everybody knows too, who's listening to this podcast, if you are experiencing pregnancy insomnia, there's a lot of different reasons why this could be happening. But one I think that no one discusses enough is this idea that you're having these sort of dips in blood sugar throughout the night. And one of the things that your body does to help to raise your blood sugar back up, there's a little bit of a squirt of cortisol that happens in that process, and it can wake us up, and it can kind of, which would make sense, right? Because it's like, hello, go eat, like go do something about this, but that's not fun for you to experience. And so if we need to keep something next to our bed, or you know, if you do need to get up and go and take care of and eat something so that you can get that good restful sleep, then that is important. So, okay, this was really helpful. Thank you for recapping all of that testing. So now let's talk about the management. You have an entire book about this, which we will link in the show notes. That's fantastic and amazing. That's why we're talking with you, because you are, you know, such a wealth of knowledge on this. And so can you kind of speak a little bit about what's the conventional advice that's given to somebody who is diagnosed with gestational diabetes? And you know, does that advice actually make sense with what we know is best for gestational diabetes? And what would you offer as the alternative, or sort of more of like a root cause functional perspective?
Yeah. So the conventional standard is a kind of an offshoot of our conventional guidelines, where macronutrient breakdown is about the same as the general population, 45 to 65% of calories coming from carbohydrates, small amount of protein, mainly lean protein, low fat, low salt. The guidance is really around splitting up your carbohydrate load evenly throughout the day between three meals and three snacks, so that you don't have a huge portion relative to your other meals anyways of carbohydrates coming in all at one sitting. It's like, let's spread it out. But when you dive into how many carbs are included in these typical meal plans, it is a bit of a head scratcher, right? So the guidelines say no less than 175 grams of carbohydrates per day in pregnancy. And so all of the conventional meal plans you see for gestational diabetes follow that guidance. And some of them have more carbs than that because they're trying to hit, usually they don't like to go lower than maybe 40% of calories from carbs. So they're trying to hit some sort of minimum relative to the caloric intake. So you're seeing carb levels of 30, 45, 60, 75 sometimes grams of carbohydrates per meal with 15 to 30 grams of carbs per snack. So what happens in the real world, and ask me how I know, because early on I was a good little dietitian who followed the rules and implemented these meal plans with, you know, clients I was seeing in clinic. What happens is this is too many carbohydrates for somebody with insulin resistance. It is too many. I mean, think about it. Somebody has failed a glucose tolerance test of 50, 75, or 100 grams of glucose, and now we're giving them an equivalent quantity of carbohydrates at each meal.
Yeah.
It doesn't work. Like, why are we expecting their blood sugar to be normal? They failed the glucose tolerance test with that amount. So what happens is it doesn't help control their blood sugar levels. They experience high blood sugar. And the response is that you can't go lower than 175 grams of carbs per day for reasons that aren't actually true per the research. That's the whole reason I wrote Real Food for Gestational Diabetes. But nonetheless, conventionally, you can't go lower than that. Therefore, you need to start on insulin and medication.
Oh my gosh.
That's the trajectory.
They say, wait, really quick to interrupt you. They say you can't go lower than that because what?
There are fears that your body will go into ketosis, and per conventional advice, they think that ketones are harmful for fetal brain development.
Okay, but we think that that is not going to probably happen at that level of carbohydrate. And then what do you think about ketones for fetal brain?
This is like a 2-hour conversation, so I'll try to like keep it as short and sweet. So this is something that I had to research in detail before I ever recommended anybody eat lower than 175 grams of carbs, because as a clinician, the last thing you want to do is harm somebody's baby's brain development, right?
Like, right.
What the heck? So essentially, every pregnant woman goes in and out of ketosis all the time, nutritional ketosis. It is a physiologically normal state, particularly in pregnancy. You're like 3 times more likely to be in ketosis when you wake up in the morning when you're pregnant than when you're not pregnant. Because guess what? Our body has all these backup fuel systems that it uses when you need a consistent supply of energy. So even with an overnight fast, or sometimes even between meals, you'll dip into ketosis when you're pregnant. The concept that it'll harm fetal neurodevelopment is incorrect. It stems from data on diabetic ketoacidosis or starvation ketosis, neither of which are the same as the ketosis you experience when you're eating a sufficient amount of food, just a lower amount of carbohydrates. First of all, the ketone levels that you're going to have in your bloodstream are going to be far lower than in either of those situations. Starvation ketosis or DKA, which, by the way, DKA typically only happens in somebody with a form of diabetes where they require insulin shots and they're not taking enough insulin. Therefore, their body starts breaking down their own body fat for fuel, and ketones are a byproduct. You don't see diabetic ketoacidosis in somebody who's producing their own insulin, particularly not in pregnancy when your insulin production is like double or triple normal, right? You have high insulin levels. You're not going to go into DKA, okay? Unless you're a type 1 who's not taking your insulin.
Because your insulin, just so that people are just to track it there, your insulin is going to bring the glucose into your cells so that you have that fuel. And so when you right. have higher insulin, you're going to have, you know, a quicker clearance rather of the blood right. sugar so that it can get into there.
And so in DKA, you also have extremely high blood sugar levels, which we're not seeing that in pregnancy, right? So you're not going to have blood sugar in the 400s, 500s, 600s, or whatever, unless you're in that very specific, you know, clinical diagnosis and not taking enough insulin. So essentially, we have not made a distinction between the different types of ketosis. if you look at studies of babies who've been exposed to diabetic ketoacidosis or have been born to mothers who are starving, their brain development is indeed harmed. This yeah. should be obvious. Anyone exposed to complete starvation, you've yes. got a problem. Any baby exposed to the extreme medical emergency that is DKA with blood sugar levels off the charts, ketone levels off the charts, acidic blood pH, yes, that is a harmful situation for their neurodevelopment. But we don't see that in somebody who's experiencing a nutritional ketosis. And in fact, it's almost impossible to avoid some level of ketosis during pregnancy. I mean, both of my pregnancies, every time they test my urine, ketones present, ketones present, ketones present, ketones present. If I had had a really strict kind of medical provider, if I wasn't fighting back against the bad advice, they would have been like, eat more carbs, eat more carbs, eat more carbs to avoid these ketones, when it's simply a natural physiologic state that you go into ketosis in pregnancy.
So then can we talk what it happens because the body is trying to maintain adequate nutrition for
a consistent fuel supply to yes. the baby. So between meals or in an overnight fast, when you don't have as much glucose present in your bloodstream and you need to send other types of fuels, your body very readily switches to burning fat and sending ketones to the baby for their development. Plus, the fetal brain actually gets 30% of its energy from ketones specifically. We now have data that the placenta creates ketones very intentionally to send them to baby. Maternal ketone levels will actually often be lower than baby's ketone levels. They're being manufactured by the placenta for the baby's brain development. When babies are born, they're in ketosis. They stay in ketosis for at least the first month of life. It is the natural physiological design that we go into ketosis more, especially as we get later in pregnancy. Your body has accrued all its body fat. And now we need to like send as much fuel as possible to this very rapidly growing baby. They're putting on a lot of weight very quickly. That can't all be supplied by glucose, nor do you want it to all be supplied by glucose, because if the baby's exposed to really high blood sugar levels the whole time, they have really high insulin levels. Once they're born, you cut the cord, you cut that sugar supply, they go hypoglycemic. Babies that have naturally been sort of incubated in this, in a person who doesn't have high blood sugar levels, they've had regular exposure to all different fuel types. So they can switch to fat burning mode with no problem. And arguably they are born in fat burning mode because they're in ketosis. And until that mature milk, you know, maternal milk switches from colostrum to mature milk, which may take 3, 4, 5 days, they're actually burning body fat, and colostrum is very high fat. They're burning fat for fuel. So if they can't make that adaptation, that's when you have major medical emergencies with that transitional time in, you know, early on after birth. So anyways, the whole concept that ketones are supposedly neurotoxic is a not accurate representation. There's actually a paper that came out, I believe it was 2021, that essentially exonerates like everything that I've been writing about. I mean, the whole last chapter of Real Food for Gestational Diabetes is about this ketone issue, because that's the biggest hurdle that medical providers will face with being comfortable at recommending less than 175 grams of carbs per day. Which, by the way, you know what's interesting? A paper came out, I believe it was just this year, I think it was 2024, where they looked at maternal carbohydrate intake and blood ketone levels. Up until recently, we didn't have data, all that much data on maternal blood ketone levels. It was almost always urine ketones, which is silly because they're really not a reflection of blood ketone levels necessarily. They're not correlated. And they found that it didn't matter the level of carbohydrates that women ate. You had women eating really low carb who had, like, there was no correlation. From eating very low carb to eating over 300 grams of carbs, there was no correlation with maternal carbohydrate intake and maternal ketone levels, which is absolutely shocking. But like, clearly, some of these women who are more keto adapted, they're using up the ketones for fuel. So they're not getting to dangerously high ketone levels. Like, as long as you're eating enough calories, you have to trust that your body has the capacity to use that energy for fuel in whatever way it's going to use it. And if you eat lower carb, you're going to be creating and burning more ketones. If you don't eat lower carb, you're going to be more in a glucose burning state, probably in an ideal world or typical scenario. You're going to be somewhere in between where you're switching between burning glucose in the fed state and burning fat and ketones in the fasted state, definitely overnight, but oftentimes even between meals. So it just is what it is.
Let's take a quick break to hear a word from our sponsors.
It's no secret that most women are not getting adequate protein in their daily diets. We need protein for all major body functions, including hormone production, to maintain a healthy, regular menstrual cycle. The requirements for protein only increase when we become pregnant, are nursing, and recovering postpartum. There are many options on the market for protein and collagen powders out there, and we understand that it can be tricky to vet all of the various brands and types. So let me make it easy for you. The Needed Collagen Powder is my top recommendation for an easy to mix, quick dissolving, and completely tasteless supplemental protein for many reasons. It's grass-fed, sustainably sourced, and has 14 grams of protein per scoop. It passes rigorous third-party testing for heavy metals contamination, and the company keeps this information transparent for the public. I mix mine into coffee, oatmeal, or smoothies almost every day. Head to thisisneeded.com and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 20%. Again, head to thisisneeded.com and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save.
Okay, back to the show.
What is happening then in the situation like you and me waking up in the middle of the night? If we tested our blood sugar, it was maybe on like a little bit of low end, not like dangerous, but our bodies are going into ketosis probably in that time period to maintain the consistent level of fuel, but still we're getting the signal of hunger because it's just, I don't know. Do you see what I'm saying? Like, why wouldn't we just be able to make it all the way through if we can go into ketosis like that?
Probably in that scenario, you and I both need more calories. Like,
just overall. Yeah.
Wherever probably. The calories are coming from, we need more. It sounds like you and I are both like fast metabolism kind of individuals by default. And probably if we had more body fat for fuel, that wouldn't happen. Okay. Like, I could tell you after my second baby, I don't know that I gained all that much more weight, but I lost it more slowly postpartum, which was actually such a relief because I wasn't having the waking in the middle of the night being hungry because my body can rely on using some of those body fat stores for fuel. It was like, oh, thank goodness I'm not getting woken up all the time.
Yeah.
So I have a feeling what's happening there is there's just energy deficit as a whole. Certainly in those scenarios, when we're pregnant, waking in the middle of the night hungry, we need calories. And we certainly were in ketosis. And your body is also kicking in that sort of backup liver gluconeogenesis, like create and release glucose from our stored glycogen in our liver to bring our blood sugar up a little bit. But we're still definitely burning ketones at that time as well. I think both were happening and there's a need for more calories.
Overall, sometimes, just more input. Yeah.
Yeah. Like sometimes you can avoid it by eating a lot more food in the evening and having a bedtime snack. And I would do all of those things. But sometimes you hit this, like, you can only fit so much food in your stomach when you're really pregnant. And then sometimes if you eat too much, you get the heartburn issue, which then you're not going to sleep. And so for me, it was like, sometimes I just got to do like, this is what's feeling more comfortable. And I'm going to wake up in the middle of the night for a snack if I need it, because like front loading all that food before bed, like, would make me more miserable. Right.
Yes.
But I think individuals who have a little more body fat on board, they can usually avoid that scenario.
They can get through that.
Starving.
Well, that's fascinating. This is just, you know, I know there's so many things like this where the research and the physiology and what we know about the physiology is not catching up to what the guidelines are. And they just will hold these stringent numbers and rules. And it takes what I think the stat is that it takes like 10 years to be implemented between like when the research says one thing to
17 years, but
no,
yeah.
No, golly. Oh, it's so frustrating to where the policy changes. So this is where, you know, it's one of the points of our podcast episodes to say, hey, it's not that we think that the medical system is like terrible and awful, but there is this sort of cultural like thread that, well, it's, of course it's the most up to date. Of course it's following the research in the moment and changing yearly to reflect what we know. And so, and it's just like, I really wish it was that way, guys, but it's not. So we need to understand this and know this and then have to look outside of the system for information like your work and your book to say, no, actually, none of these conventional gestational diabetes guidelines for diet and the way to manage it are consistent with what we know is going to actually be the best, right? So, okay, so let's get back to that point. Can you keep going with what sort of like, what is, the conventional, and then what is your alternative too?
Yeah, so the alternative, it's not rocket science. You test your blood sugar. You eat a relatively balanced macronutrient intake, not ridiculously high in carbohydrates. And I'd argue that our guidelines are far too high. So emphasizing a little more protein, not fearing fat, and eating quality carbohydrates in a portion that results in normal blood sugar readings after your meal. You match your food intake to what the meter is telling you. Eat to the meter. So what this looks like relative to the conventional guidelines is your carb intake is usually not nearly as high. Now, I, in Real Food for Gestational Diabetes, I give three different levels of carbs in the sample meal plans, showing you how really how easy it is to go up or down from one to the other. Oftentimes it's just one or two portions of carbs, maybe that changes whether you fall into a higher, moderate, or lower amount. But essentially, you're going to be eating less typically than the guidelines. That's just how it works. You're going to have a larger portion of your plate coming from protein. And by default, when you reduce the carbohydrates, you have to make up the calories somewhere else. So other than what's coming in from protein, you have to eat fat in its place, which is actually not hard to do. It's harder to follow the low-fat dietary guidelines than it is to eat just a normal amount of fat. Because unless you're taking the fat out of every single thing, it's really hard to comply with their 30% of calories coming from fat. People are shocked when they actually sit down and do like a macronutrient analysis on their diet. And they're like, oh my God, I'm getting half of my calories from fat. I'm like, yeah, that's like really easy to do. And arguably, probably closer to the norm for most humans, rather than trying to get 30%. That's just really, really restrictive. So a big focus for a lot of people needs to be on getting breakfast right in terms of macronutrients. That really sets the stage for better blood sugar levels later in the day. So a heavier emphasis on protein, particularly at breakfast, because you already have higher insulin resistance in the morning. You have a surge of placental hormones. You have a surge of cortisol that drives insulin resistance. So we need typically lower carb in the morning, higher protein, and some fat that typically comes with the protein portion. And that really sets the stage for better hunger fullness cues, better blood sugar regulation, keeps our insulin levels in check. Like everything is better when we just fix the breakfast issue. I've never had more difficulty with a client than when they just cling to having something like cereal for breakfast or like a bagel or something. It's a blood sugar nightmare. So you've got to get the protein in the morning. Usually people have a little bit more wiggle room for carbs at their other meals, but it really does depend on the client. Blood sugar is one of those just challenging things to manage where everybody has their own individual profile. It sounds like you've done some CGM experimenting yourself. We have different types of carbs that some of us do well with, some of us don't. You know, for me, like rice and oatmeal are just a complete nightmare for my blood sugar, but the next person, that might be okay, but like sweet potatoes are terrible or a banana is terrible, you know, and you just have to do some experimenting with different types of foods to see what your response is. But that's really it. Like instead of applying arbitrary rules on you have to have this threshold of this or that, it's really about focusing on your macronutrient balance. Protein sufficiency is where I focused first. And then looking at carbohydrate quality is probably my next area of focus. So what types of carbs are coming in. Is it mostly processed foods? So it's like white flour and added sugars. That's going to be a bigger issue for your blood sugar than winter squash or beans or lentils or a whole grain sourdough bread or a whole piece of fruit, right? So we have to be looking at just the quality of the diet as a whole. It does make a surprising difference.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that you said that because it's one of Leah, my co-host's favorite, not favorite, but most effective treatment methods for everything is breakfast. Yes. Getting people's breakfast. It's so wild. Of course, you know, everything, it's like we're living in the upside down, like that Stranger Things show where literally so many things in our culture are just the mainstream way is the exact opposite of what actually needs to be happening. And so many of the breakfast foods with the sugar in the cereals and oatmeal and even just like, you know, low fat Yoplait yogurt with like oat granola on top or muffins, donuts, like what a nightmare. All of this, the things that we need to be eating for breakfast are yes, so protein and fat heavy. And so like recently, just as another aside, I know I keep talking about myself, but I just as a something that has been surprising to me, my husband loves to make, so our kids, we have three little kids that can eat, you know, we have four, but we have three that eat. And he loves to make these waffles with that like Kodiak waffle blend that has higher protein in it. And you know, he's learning all the things, but he's not quite there yet. He reads that label and he goes, well, there's so much protein in this. This is great. And I tried to get behind that because sometimes, yeah, you get sick of eating eggs. Like we have tons of chicken. We love our eggs, but sometimes it's just like you want to mix it up. I literally cannot eat those things. Like I feel so bad within just a couple of, I don't know, maybe like 45 minutes. I am crashing. I'm shaky. I'm just like, no. This, yeah, I don't care that there's this added. It's so highly processed. This product is like not real food. And the amount of carbohydrate in it cancels and the type of the carbohydrate, it cancels the whole thing. Same thing with steel cut oats. No matter if I add collagen powder and peanut butter to it, it's just not enough. Like I think we can combo some of these. It's like habit stacking, right? Like we know that if you can tolerate eggs are one of the highest forms of choline. We need to be getting in a target range of like 800 to 900 milligrams of choline per day for the optimal fetal neurodevelopment. There's an episode that I have with another naturopathic doctor and colleague, Dr. Ari Calhoun, that I'll put in the show notes. That's all about optimizing fetal neurodevelopment. That's one of the things that is a takeaway there. And eggs are one of the highest forms of choline. So it's like, if you tolerate them, if you like them, if you can, you know, you're not vomiting up your eggs or whatever, that is a great way. A couple of eggs, three pregnant women, you know, two, three at least, like not one egg, not just the yolk or just the white either. We need to eat the whole thing. And then with some kind of like a breakfast meat or what Leah's favorite thing to do is just eat leftovers from your dinner. It doesn't have to be breakfast food. It doesn't have to be something that's kind of like a specialty, you know, meal type. It can be just a meat and veggie kind of combination that you've already had for your sort of typical lunch or typical dinner. And one of the things she loves to do is eat like salmon for breakfast. That's like the thing that makes her feel the best. And it is true. I've tried it before. It feels weird to do when you're like culturally, you've grown up doing these different kinds of meals. But man, it is amazing. Breakfast is literally, you know, you're breaking the fast. It's just this huge opportunity to start your day off right. And if it means that you have to wake up a little bit earlier to make it happen or prep something the night before, or you're heating it up and then you're eating it on your drive to work, like not ideal, but if it's, you know, 30 grams of protein and 15 grams of fat or more, something like that, and then however many carbs kind of work its way into that, the experimentation is another note that is so key because people just read these guidelines. They're like, oh, rice is bad for you, or like oats are bad for you. And it's like, well, you have to see how your body deals with it because for some reason, rice actually goes okay with me, but oats do not. And I
interesting.
I don't know why. If I were to only eat rice, no, but I only ever eat it like in a stir fry type sense where there's like lots of meat and fat and whatever. Right. So it's okay. But I just am so glad you said that because it's something we harp on all the time for fertility, for hormone regulation, for just feeling well. Your blood sugar balance and the way that it goes up and down is inextricably linked to then now the way that your hormones will cascade. So for those that are trying to conceive or that are trying to regulate your menstrual cycles, one of the best things you can do is keep your blood sugar regular. And one of the best things to do that you can do for that is to eat a very good, hearty, proteinaceous and fat-rich breakfast. Yep. And it just really is such a different day. And if people haven't really had the experience of paying attention to that, I ask, you know, I invite you to experiment, because you'll be shocked at how much you might actually eat more in the day when you have a small, insufficient, or kind of like quick carbohydrate breakfast than when you eat, like, say you're trying to watch your weight, you know. Then when you eat like a lot, it seems maybe counterintuitive. You eat a lot of calories, a lot of fat and protein at your breakfast. You're probably going to eat overall less in the daytime. And it's just, we know this, and we are not heeding this in our cultural day-to-day dietary, you know, way. It's so frustrating.
Pregnant or not too. I write about a study in my other book, Real Food for Fertility, in the PCOS chapter, about how they assigned women with PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome, two different groups. They had the same caloric intake, but they had one group eat a higher, larger breakfast, moderate lunch, small dinner. And the other group did the opposite. They did a small breakfast, moderate lunch, large dinner. And the improvements in metabolic health was like dramatic in the group that did the large breakfast, even though they are really eating pretty much the majority of their calories at breakfast. And I know from my own self-experimentation over the years, I have to fall into that category of having most of my food, like front-loading my food in the early part of the day, even if it means having like two breakfasts, like splitting it up, because like, oh, that's too much at one time.
Yeah.
It's like front-loading the calories in the early part of the day really makes a dramatic difference. And if people want to read more, I mean, I've been writing about this forever, so I'm in agreement with you too. I have an article probably from, I don't know, 2012, 2013, called The Healthy Breakfast Mistake. I have articles on my CGM experiments on my site. One of them, the first CGM experiment, I was just doing it with my normal diet, and then I'm like, I'm going to test out oatmeal. per the prenatal guidelines that have a sample meal plan from the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, that's like oats, strawberries, and like skim milk or something terrible. I had a 100 point spike in my blood sugar. 100, it went up 100 points. And then hypoglycemic, of course. And then in the second experiment, which I wrote about in my CGM experiment too, I tried out oatmeal with other stuff, you know, added to it, protein, whatever. I can't remember the exact things that I built into that. And I had a lesser spike. I mean, arguably in line with the research that says you might see a 30, 40% drop in your spike when you combine your carbs with protein, but it was still a substantial spike compared to my normal breakfast. And my normal breakfasts have carbs. It's like oats in particular are highly problematic for me personally, not saying that's everybody, but typically the way that people consume them, the quantity of carbs consumed is so much larger when you're having an oatmeal breakfast versus having a piece of sourdough toast or a side of sweet potatoes or something with your eggs, that I think it's just too much for a lot of individuals. So it really does take some self-experimentation. You don't even have to check your blood sugar to like prove this to yourself. The symptoms you described of feeling like really hungry or shaky or irritable or low energy or whatever, that's a sign that you have spiked and crashed your blood sugar. You're just getting it, you know, seeing that through symptoms versus a readout of the exact number. So again, I cannot harp on this any more than you already have. Try out getting a higher protein breakfast, do it for like 2 or 3 days, then revert to your usual and see the difference. I mean, a lot of people just never go back, myself included. I mean, I'll occasionally be like, I'm going to have a croissant for breakfast. And then be like, that was a terrible choice.
Immediate regret.
Do this. delicious, but I don't like the consequences of feeling like garbage the rest of the day.
Okay. And so then, you know, there are other things that I know you highlight in the book, like there's different nutritional supplementation that can be done to help with blood sugar management and things. So I just encourage people to read your book and get it if this is further interesting to you. And I will also link in the show notes those articles like the breakfast mistake one that you mentioned and the CGM experiments so people can read more there. But then I do, just before we leave, I want to just touch on the way that this kind of a diagnosis could impact birth plans. And the way that this is an important, you know, we have our motivation enough to not have unmanaged high blood sugar readings because we do know the other negative benefits, or sorry, negative risks to baby and to you, and then to that post-birth hypoglycemic drop that newborns can have if they've been incubated in a high blood sugar environment for many months, you know. But I just think that this is something that people kind of are maybe a little bit unaware of, that if you are given a gestational diabetes diagnosis, and let's say this is your first baby, and you are much more likely to go to like 41 plus 3 days or something like that with your gestational, or your gestational time into going into spontaneous labor as a first-time mom. And I think as a subsequent pregnancy, it drops only to like 40 plus five. It's only drops by a few days. Basically, my point is that going past the due date is extremely common if we're looking at spontaneous labor. And you will not even come close to that option if you are diagnosed with gestational diabetes. There, sometimes it depends on your hospital and their policies, but sometimes they want to induce at 38 weeks or 39 weeks, or maybe even just schedule C-sections. So I've heard all sorts of different things. So I wondered if you could just speak to that. And to the idea of the woman maybe who was diagnosed with gestational diabetes, but then really reels it in and gets it managed, how maybe that can be managed with your individual provider to show and prove and say, hey, look, I'm changed things, and my glucose levels are now within the normal range. And even though I have this diagnosis, I am not being the manifestation of the diagnosis anymore.
Yeah. A big frustration of mine in this field as a whole, and I think why so many women want to try to avoid the diagnosis, is that it often leads to an over-medicalization of your pregnancy. And is just an unfortunate fact of our current maternal healthcare system. They see gestational diabetes as everyone's going to have the worst possible outcome, instead of looking at it on a spectrum and looking at it relative to maternal blood sugar levels. Outcomes are very much tied to whether your blood sugar was mostly in range or mostly out of range, and how out of range it was. And we see it's a linear relationship between your blood sugar levels and the risk for having some of these adverse consequences. I can't speak to what your provider is going to do or not do. I mean, I certainly made choices in my pregnancies to go with providers who were the least likely to jump to interventions for no good reason and birth in a place where I wouldn't be sabotaged. I mean, I had both my babies at home, so you can, you know, that was actually really important to me. Even though I didn't necessarily have any of these scarlet letters on my chart, I didn't want it to be sabotaged. I think that's why we see so many women choosing places of birth and providers that are more supportive of this. I think you could potentially, if you have a provider who you think is going to like jump the gun and recommend, you know, early induction or one of these things, you could point them to the data from the hyperglycemia and adverse pregnancy outcome study, the HAPO study, which shows that the risk of certain adverse things happening is very closely tied to maternal blood sugar levels. So oftentimes they're concerned that the baby is going to be born too large, right? And the risk of baby being macrosomic is highly tied to maternal blood sugar levels. It's not the only potential risk factor. Genetics play a big role. Maternal weight gain plays a big role as well. But blood sugar is a modifiable risk factor. So you could show them that data.
Macrosomia meaning like big body, like a bigger baby. So that is one of the things that at the end of the pregnancy, if you've had a higher blood sugar reading consistently, you know, you're building a bigger baby, and they worry that the baby will not be able to be born, will get stuck, shoulder dystocia, different negative birth outcomes that way. So they're always like, well, your baby's too big, we need to induce you now, or your baby could be too big, we need to induce you, or let's not even attempt vaginal birth, we're just going to schedule a section, and then here comes a 7-pound baby. And it's like,
and that it opens up a whole can of worms, because even checking baby's size late in pregnancy is extremely inaccurate. I've seen difference of 2 pounds. You know, I have a gestational diabetes online course that I've been running continuously for about 10 years now. So I hear all the different outcomes stories and all the different birth stories. And for the ones who have been, you know, bullied into an unnecessary induction or early C-section because they're worried their baby's too large, in almost all of those cases, the baby was a lot smaller than they had predicted. And like I said, sometimes they're like, oh, it's going to be a 9-pound baby, 7 pounds. Like, really? Right. But at the same time, sometimes you do have providers who are more willing to see the full picture and more willing to be like, okay, your blood sugar's looking great. It's as if you don't even have this diagnosis. And they won't push things like early induction or an unnecessary C-section. And we see brilliant outcomes. I mean, the vast majority of the women that I've worked with have really, really excellent outcomes where you don't see any of the potential effects of gestational diabetes on that baby. I will say that if you're working with a provider who does more high-risk pregnancy stuff, their clientele is typically less healthy at baseline, and they do see the scary and adverse outcomes. And so they're doing it out of like, we want to be, you know, it's better safe than sorry. So if you find yourself birthing with a provider like that, I think there's a greater chance that they will sort of treat you like a statistic instead of looking more closely at, you know, how everything is managed. If you have a provider who has seen positive outcomes with gestational diabetes, well-controlled cases where everything's fine, they might be more willing to work with you. But I think it's a fight worth having. And I think it's worth making really, you know, informed choices about who and where, you know, you're going to have your baby so that you can avoid some of those interventions if at all possible. I mean, we want to be smart. If there is a higher chance of something going awry, you do want to have medical care close by. That's what our system is brilliant at handling, as medical emergencies. But at the same time, they tend to not be as brilliant at sort of letting spontaneous labor unfold, because it doesn't always unfold on their precise timeline that they want. And then you
I think that they have a hard time just letting it be without meddling. Cause it's like, you know, that feeling of, well, I want to do something. I need to find a problem. I need to sort of like be doing something, be helpful. But really, honestly, with birth, it's reversed in so many, the vast majority of instances. It's like the way you can be the most helpful is to do nothing.
Nothing.
And just watch and wait until there's an actual emergency. But so you said something, it's like, yeah, it's almost as if you say you were diagnosed maybe in, whether that's from the early trimester, first trimester, hemoglobin A1C, or from the 24 to 28 week glucose tolerance test, something, whatever it is initially, but then you made some big changes. You were able to get it under control. You figured it out. You were like really motivated and were able to, which some people won't be able to. And that is just the way that it is too. Maybe because they don't have all of the resources and options and stuff. Maybe they don't even know. Maybe they do really try, but it's just something about their body's predisposition prior to pregnancy probably. And then now we're in this pregnant state and it's just not happening. But let's just pretend that you did get it under control. You show your practitioner. It's like it's as if you don't even have, you shouldn't really even have that diagnosis anymore, because it's like, yes, at this one point in time, we didn't manage our blood sugar properly. Okay, yeah, now you came back, you did the next set of the tests, it still didn't happen. But now you've made these huge changes. You are not consistently having high blood sugar readings that you now don't have. You should. I mean, they're not going to remove it from the chart, but in their mind, if they're open-minded and critical thinkers, they can say, okay, this person, I'm not worried about these things. It still may be a good idea if at any point you know, we think that there was periods of months of unmanaged blood sugar, to have something on hand at the birth, like whether you've harvested colostrum or you have a little bit of donor milk, just in the event, and kind of prep your mind and get your mind wrapped around the idea. Or let's just say you are like type 1 diabetic or something, that your baby may be hypoglycemic at birth and need some assistance with that. And, you know, that can be well managed at home or in a birth center as well, where it's like, we know that this could be a potential, what's the treatment? Okay, we give the baby some milk or some colostrum of some kind of, from, it could be from harvested from mom. It could be something else if we need like more of that like white milk and not just the colostrum. But it's like that can be also something that can be taken care of in like this more, I don't know what the word is, like holistic is so overused. I don't mean holistic, but like in a whole lens view of this person and this baby and this situation. And it's, I understand it's difficult for a lot of providers to keep that individual lens through every patient. It's so much easier to say, this is the protocol, this is the blah, 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 like as if we're a factory line. And it's just like, but we're not. And this is where we, as the women, need to continue to advocate for ourselves and say, you know, either, like you said, seeking out somebody who can do it with you and for you, or you're going to keep fighting and you're going to keep pushing. And it is a worthy cause.
Yeah. I mean, I've had clients with even type 1 diabetes have home births, you know, yep. Like some of it might come down to there's different rules and regulations in different states or areas that, you know, in some states you like risk out of midwifery care if you even have a gestational diabetes diagnosis, which is crazy. There's others where you might risk out if you require insulin or something, right? Yes. There's different, these are all arbitrary in my opinion as well. Not that anybody asked, but those are all arbitrary and silly. They should have more context and nuance than just making those blanket statements. But nonetheless, like sometimes the choices are taken away based on how your condition has been managed too, which is unfortunate. But I do know individuals who have had all the odds stacked against them. I mean, like type ones, they want to medicalize the heck out of you, who have still been able to manage a perfectly healthy home birth, or, you know, birth center birth or something. So it is possible. And the better you're able to manage your blood sugar levels, the less likely you're going to risk out of those, however arbitrary, rules, right? The less fighting you have to do for your rights to birth in the way that you want to birth and where you want to birth. So that's the best that I can offer, is like giving women the best chance at managing this in a way that you don't risk out of care.
Yes. And thank you for that option. All of Lily's information, the articles, the website, the courses, the Instagram, the book will all be in the show notes so that you guys can check this out. And thank you just so much for your, you know, continuous drive to putting out the more useful and up-to-date information out there for people to use. And it's been such a joy having you on the podcast now multiple different times and for this part 2 series. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Getting sick while pregnant or breastfeeding is tricky, not only because you feel like crap and need to get back on your feet to grow and take care of your children, but also because you may not know what is safe or effective to take and do to help yourself. The internet is not very helpful when it comes to searching for cold and flu remedies that are safe while pregnant and breastfeeding, so I've made a course that outlines it all for you. I also threw in allergy remedies as well as natural UTI care, because often there are things that can be done to prevent the need for antibiotics. Moms really shouldn't be allowed to get sick, but here we are. Find the course link in the show notes and get back to feeling well by supporting your immune system naturally and safely. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Healthy as a Mother podcast. In order for others to hear this information, please leave a review with Apple Podcasts, subscribe, and send to a friend who could benefit from this content. We're so excited to share more on becoming and being a mother next time.
And please remember that the ideas and views of this podcast are for informational purposes only and are not intended to serve as a substitute for medical care of any kind, including the diagnosis or treatment of any illness or disease. Consult with your provider before integrating this information into your own care plan. And remember, a healthier future starts now, and it starts with you.